just give an introduction about what's happening here at Constance and how this centre came to be. So collective behaviour is becoming a very important theme here at the university. And when we think of collectives, certainly when I think of collective behaviour, we often think of animal groups, schooling fish and flocking birds. And us scientists actually only have a rudimentary understanding of how unrelated organisms like this coordinate their behaviour in this fashion. But in actual fact, collective behaviour at Constance actually goes down to the micron scale, the work by Clemens Meschinger here in the audience, looking at how microscopic particles, micron-sized particles, can be driven to interact with each other to exhibit collective behaviour with future medical possibilities, for example, to search for tumours inside the body. In biology, there's many aspects of collective behaviour, from swarm formation in pest insects, such as these locusts, to work that Lucy Applin here in Constance is doing on the spread of culture in animal populations. It may be a surprise to you that animals have transmissible culture, and that's one of the other areas of expertise here. And we, of course, are also embedded in a collective. The person in the middle there in a hat is in an elevator. And unbeknown to him, the other people in this elevator are actors. And just watch how he behaves in response to them. So we think of ourselves as very complex organisms, and indeed we are in many contexts. But we're also subtly, subconsciously, or not so subtly, subconsciously manipulating and affecting each other's behaviour. And so our work extends from the physical sciences to the biological sciences, and also to the psychological and social sciences, where people here study, for example, how dietary decisions, what you eat, is actually affected by what others around you are eating. And this can actually spread over networks of social systems. You also need to think about economics, because there can be conflicts within society. People may have different incentives. And so how can they come to decisions effectively? And how can we solve problems such as climate change when we have selfish individuals underlying the decision making? And another hallmark of what we're developing here in Constance is highly advanced computational tools that allow us, in this example, to track the motion in the head direction of hundreds of pedestrians in natural environments, this is not in Constance. And again, unbeknown to these pedestrians, there are actors within that crowd manipulating subconscious aspects of their behaviour. And we study animals also in the non-human animals, also in the natural environment. These are some birds from very nearby Constance that, working with Martin Michalski at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology, we can track the motion of these birds and understand how and why they behave. And so I'm the director at the Max Planck Institute for Ornithology, but also a professor here at the university. So we're really integrating these two institutes. And this particular data set can actually track the animals as they migrate over large proportions of our planet. So here in Constance, we're creating the world's first center for the study of collective behavior. Some of you who are familiar with the campus may have seen the construction. This is a rendering. This building is currently being constructed, and this includes, this is really to bring together computer science and biology, economics and psychology, so we're living and working together in the same space, and underground we have a large imaging environment where we can really conduct experiments that no one else in the world can do. This is 15 by 15 by 8 meters, that's the big, big box that you see on the side of the building if you've seen the construction. This year, also working with co-speakers for the Fish Market in Economics, Oliver Doyson in Computer Science, and around 30 other faculty, some of whom I mentioned today across the university, we were successful in being awarded a major grant. So we have 31 million euros for the first 7 years, and this is renewable for a further seven, to set up a centre that really tries to cross these scales of biological organisation and to try to really have Constance be the focus of this new type of science. So we aim to make Constance the global center for the study of collective behavior. We started in January on this new initiative, so give us some time. We want a very dynamic, interdisciplinary, and open community, and an active engagement with the broader community here in Constance and in our region. And that's the reason today that we have our very first public lecture to try to explain some of the excitement regarding social behavior to you. And so we have a wonderful speaker today. I'm very, very excited to have you here today. So as you probably know from the posters, he's a professor and university scholar in the Department of Biology at the University of Louisville, where he works on the evolution of social behavior as well as the history of science. He's published over 150 scientific papers in leading journals such as Nature and the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But in addition, he is one of the few scientists who really has spent a lot of time and has got great skill in communicating his science to the broader public. He's the author of many popular science books, including How to Tame a Fox and Build a Dog, which we will hear about today, but also Mr. Jefferson and the Giant Moose, The Altruism Equation, and others. Now, the book on which he's going to focus his talk today, How to Tame a Fox and Build a Dog, was the winner of the American Association for the Advancement of Science Subaru Prize for Excellence in Science Books, Forbes magazine's number one on its 10 best science books in 2017, one of the New York Times science writer, Carl Zimmer, one of my heroes in science writing, must reads. One of the Conversation's 5 must read science books, one of Science Magazine's best science books, and one of Science News' favorite books of the year. We chatted earlier today, and I believe there's going to be a children's edition that's going to be released. I'm really excited to have you here, Liam Gavin.
So you want cute, you want smart, you want loyal, and you definitely want unconditional love. The thing is, you do not need to build this, because for the last 60 years, a dedicated team of Russian scientists in Siberia have been building it for you. The perfect dog. Except, like you might guess from the title of the talk, it's not a dog, it's a fox, a domesticated fox. They built it in the minus 40 degree winters of Siberia, but just as important, they built it in the blink of an eye in terms of evolutionary time. A hundredth of the time it took our ancestors to domesticate wolves into dogs. This is my friend and colleague and co-author, Ludmila Trut. Ludmila recently turned 85 years old, and every day, including today, for the last 60 years, she has led what's come to be known as the Silver Fox Domestication Study. And for the last 7 or 8 years, I've had the privilege of working with Ludmila as the historian of science person on this project, in order for us to try and tell the story of this incredible science to as many people as possible. So for the next 45 minutes or so, I'm going to tell you about domesticated foxes that will melt your heart and lick your ears, just like this guy did 5 seconds after they put him in my arms in Siberia. I'm going to tell you about cutting-edge science in the field of domestication. And if you think about it, this idea of domesticated animals, it's not only important for science per se, but it's important because our own human evolutionary trajectory over time changed dramatically when we started domesticating animals and plants. We would be a very different species if we had not done that. And this experiment that we're going to talk about tonight, this is the gold standard in terms of understanding how we have the domesticated animals around us that we do. The story starts in the late 1930s with this fellow right here, Dmitry Belaev. So in the late 1930s, Belyaev was an undergraduate student at a place called the Ivanova Agricultural Academy outside of Moscow. And while he was there, he was studying genetics. And because it was an agricultural academy, he had all sorts of interactions with domesticated species. Then when he graduated in the early 40s, like virtually every Soviet male of that era, he went and fought in World War II for 4 years. And when he came back, he got a position as a research scientist at a place called the Central Research Lab for Fur Breeding Animals, which is also in Moscow. And they work with many, many different species of animals there, but the two most important by far were foxes and mink. And the reason they were so important is that at this time, so the early to mid 1940s now, the Soviet Union is essentially starving to death. And fox fur and mink fur were two of the very few reliable sources of Western income coming into the Soviet Union. And it was while Belyaev was here at this institute that he came up with the idea that would eventually turn into the silver fox domestication experiment. And here's how it started. Belyaev knew from his study of genetics and from his interaction with many domesticated species at the Agricultural Academy and from his reading of Darwin's very long, detailed book about evolution and domesticated species. He knew that many domesticated species share a whole suite of similarities. So they tend to have things like floppy ears and curly tails. They tend to have juvenilized faces and bodies compared to their wild ancestors. Domesticated species tend to have low stress hormone levels. They tend to have lots of variation in their furs. And they tend to have a longer reproductive period than their wild ancestors. Not every domesticated species has every one of those, but most domesticated species have most of those characteristics. And Belyaev thought about it, and he thought, you know, this is really strange, because we domesticated animals for all sorts of different reasons. Some, like horses, we domesticated for transportation. Others we domesticated as food sources. And yet others, like dogs, we domesticated for some combination of companionship and protection. Yet no matter what we domesticate them for, we tend to find these common traits, the floppy ears, the curly tails, the low stress hormone levels. All of those characteristics today we refer to as the domestication syndrome. And Belyaev thought, why? Why do we see this no matter what we domesticate them for? And his hypothesis went like this. The one thing that our ancestors always needed when they were domesticating a species, regardless if it was for transportation or food or protection, the one thing they always needed was an animal that was not trying to bite their heads off. And so he hypothesized that the early stages of all animal domestication events in our evolutionary past, the early stages involved our ancestors choosing the calmest, tamest animals, the ones that were friendliest to humans. He further hypothesized that somehow or another, and he didn't know how, but somehow or another, all of those other characteristics in the domestication syndrome, they somehow come along for the ride when you choose the calmest, most friendly animals. And Belyaev decides that he is going to test these ideas in real time using the foxes that he now knows so well from working at the institute. And the idea that he envisions is this. Eventually, working with a team of people, he will test hundreds of foxes every year. And he will choose the friendliest ones and preferentially breed them to produce the next generation of foxes. So foxes can breed with their 1 year old and they breed every year. So every year is essentially a generation. So we'll choose the calmest ones. Then the next generation, he'll raise up those pups and he'll test them. And then he'll choose the calmest, most friendly ones and breed them, generation after generation after generation. And he will see First of all, is he in fact getting genetically calmer, more friendly animals? And if he only chooses the animals based on their behavior, does he start to see some of those other traits in the domestication syndrome appear? Now, this idea is an idea for an experiment in genetics. In the genetics of domestication, but still in genetics. And because of that, Beleyev had a problem. And it was a really big problem. Because now, by the late 1940s, it is essentially against the law to do modern, what's known as Mendelian genetics in the Soviet Union. And the reason that it's against the law is this person right here, Trofim Lysenko. Lysenko was a fraud, a charlatan, who had risen up in the ranks of Soviet science by arguing that Western genetics was bourgeois science that was being spread by wreckers and saboteurs. Instead, Lysenko said that a long disproven idea, for those scientists in the audience, Lamarckian inheritance, he claimed that this was not only correct, even though everybody knew it wasn't, but that it was more in line with Soviet science and Soviet philosophy. And so he made up data, falsified data, to make it look like he was right. And doing this, he rose up in the scientific hierarchy. But just as importantly, maybe more importantly, he rose up in the political hierarchy in the Soviet Union and became literally Stalin's right-hand man on science. So here's Lysenko giving one of these talks where he's calling Western geneticists saboteurs and wreckers. And when he's finished, Stalin stands up and yells out, "Bravo, Comrade Lysenko." Because of Lysenko, thousands of Soviet geneticists lost their jobs. Hundreds were thrown into prison, their crime being doing Western genetics. And a few dozen were actually murdered by Lysenko's thugs for studying modern genetics. This is the environment in which Beleyev is envisioning an experiment that's really an experiment in genetics. He knows how dangerous it is. He knows better than most people, because one of those 20 or so people that was killed by Lysenko and his folks was Beleyev's older brother, who was an up-and-coming star in the field of genetics. But Beleyev decides this is too important not to try. And so he decides first to run a little pilot experiment. And he has a colleague in Estonia who runs a tiny little fox farm. And there are hundreds of these fox farms around the Soviet Union, all designed to produce foxes with shiny, pretty furs that can be exported to the West. And so he works with this colleague at a little one of these farms in Estonia. And the idea is they're just going to test a small number of foxes, maybe 20 or 30 every year. And they'll take the ones that are the calmest and friendliest, and they'll preferentially breed them. And then they'll do the same thing with their pups. Very small sample size, but they do this for 4 or 5 years. And they're beginning to already see signs that the animals are inherently calmer, even after only 4 or 5 generations. And so Beleyev thinks that maybe the full-blown experiment is really worth doing. And he gets the chance to start the full-blown experiment in 1958. Because at that time, he's appointed vice director of a new institute in biology in Siberia in a city called Novosibirsk. What happened at this time was Soviet scientists working with the government cleared out a giant chunk of Siberian forest and built what is known as Akademgorodok, which still stands today. What they did was they constructed about 24 world-class institutes in science, everything from chemistry and physics to early computer science and biology, where Beleyev was the vice director now. And he knows that he's going to have the money and the power now to start a full-blown silver fox domestication experiment. But what he's not going to have as vice director, and with all the administrative things he has to do, what he's not going to have is the time to be the person to lead the experiment day after day after day. So right before he leaves Moscow to move to Siberia, he goes on the hunt for a young scientist who can be that person. And to do that, he goes to Moscow State University, which is not only one of the finest universities, but also one of the most beautiful universities in the world. And he goes to a friend of his who studies animal behavior there, and he tells him what he wants to do. And he's looking for a young scientist. And they put out the word, and one of the people that comes in to interview with Beleyev in 1958 is 25-year-old Lyudmila Trut. When you talk to Lyudmila today, even though this interview happened 61 years ago, to her, she can tell you it moment by moment as if it happened yesterday. She walked in, and the first thing that struck her was that Beleyev immediately treated her like an equal. In 1958, Soviet science was very patriarchal. But here, the vice director of a new major institute immediately treated an undergraduate who was just finishing as an equal. And that really struck Lyudmila. And then he says what he wants to do. We're going to test hundreds of foxes every year. We're going to choose the calmest, most friendly ones. We'll breed them every year, generation after generation, and we'll see, do we get calmer and calmer and friendlier animals? And do some of the other traits in the domestication syndrome start to appear? Floppy ears and curly tails and all of those things. And Lyudmila loves the idea. She thinks it's a brilliant experiment. She also loves the idea of moving to this new scientific town where they're literally bringing tens of thousands of scientists in. But Beleyev stops her for a second and says, you need to keep a few things in mind. First of all, even though Lysenko is not as powerful as he used to be, if he wants to, he can throw us in prison for doing this. And the second thing you need to know is, you know, I've done this little pilot experiment in Estonia, and the results were promising, but this is an experiment in evolution. It could take 10 years before anything interesting happens. It could take 20 years. She remembers Beleyev telling her, it could take your whole life before something really interesting happens. But she was hooked, and Beleyev liked what he saw, and he offered her the job. So 6 months later, Lyudmila and her husband and their 2-year-old daughter hop on a train from Moscow to Siberia, which is no easy train ride, to begin the full-blown silver fox domestication experiment. And from day one, Lyudmila will tell you that her motto running this experiment comes directly from the wonderful children's story, The Little Prince, where the fox in that story tells the little prince that you become responsible forever for what you have tamed. So Lyudmila goes there, and now Beleyev has money and power, but he still hasn't built yet a big experimental farm where they can do the work in Akademgorodok. He's planning to, but he hasn't gotten that far yet. So initially, Lyudmila is going to have to start the experiment somewhere else, and then they'll move to Akademgorodok. So the first year or so, Lyudmila spends traveling across the Soviet Union to all of these fox farms that are there for fur to find the perfect place to start the experiment. And eventually, she decides on this place down here called the Lesnoy Fox Farm. It's an overnight 12-hour train ride from Akademgorodok, and Lyudmila is going to go down there 4 times a year, sometimes for a couple of weeks, sometimes for a couple of months, to start the experiment. Now, this place, Lesnoy, is gigantic. It is a money-making machine for the Soviet government. At any given time, there could be 10,000 foxes at Lesnoy. And when Lyudmila first went down there and talked to the director and said what she wanted to do, he just looked at her like she was nuts, crazy. Why would you want to waste your time trying to get a friendly fox when there's so much money to be made in fox fur? But Ludmila said, Beleyev sent me down here. And that was enough. And the director said, fine, go ahead, test the 500 foxes. It's not going to bother me. So she starts the experiment. And what she's going to do is every morning she gets up and she begins testing foxes. And in a given year, she's going to test between 400 and 500 foxes. And she's going to test every fox twice, once when it's a pup, and then once when it's an adult. And the way the tests work is as following. She's going to score the foxes as she approaches their cage. She's going to score them on how friendly they are or how aggressive they are. Then she's going to score them again on how friendly or not they are when she stands by their closed cage door. Every fox is in its own cage. Then she's going to score them again when she opens the cage. And then she'll score them one last time when she puts something, either a stick or her hand in a very, very thick glove, into the fox's cage. And she'll give them a score on a scale of, she'll give them a score on a scale of 1 to 4, where 4 means relatively calm and 1 means relatively aggressive, not friendly towards her. So every fox gets scored like this, and they get scored like this twice, when they're a pup and then when they're an adult. And then Ludmila gets the total score, and then she's going to take the 10% of the males and the 10% of the females who had the highest score, the ones that were friendliest to humans, and she's going to breed them to produce the next generation of pups. Then she'll test those pups. When they get to be adults, she'll test them again. And the ones that are the friendliest overall, top 10%, she'll breed those for the next generation. When she starts the experiment, Ludmila describes the foxes at Lesnoy as essentially wild foxes. She calls them fire-breathing dragons. Most of them were very, very aggressive towards humans. But there was a little bit of variation. Some of them were a little calmer. Some of them were very calm. Even after just 2 or 3 generations of breeding the calmest, friendliest animals, there were a few, just a few, foxes like the one you're seeing here, whose name is Laska, which means gentle, that were calm enough that Ludmila could actually hold them in her arms. So every year she comes back 4 times, does this year after year after year. 5 years into the experiment, Ludmila comes up with a classification system. So there are these class 3 foxes, and these are foxes that are either very, very aggressive towards humans or they flee from humans. Mostly they're aggressive, but some of them flee. They never make the top 10%. There are now more, not a lot, but more foxes like Laska, and these are class 2 foxes. These are animals that can be handled by humans, but they don't show any emotional response to humans. And then there are what Ludmila calls class 1 foxes. These are animals that not only can be held, but they display emotional responses, friendly responses to humans. They wag their tails when Ludmila is approaching them, the way that your dog wags their tail when you're around and it's happy. They whine and whimper when Ludmila leaves, again, the way your dog would when you leave and it doesn't want you to. In 1965, the class 1 foxes made up maybe 2% of the foxes in the experiment. Today, they make up about 80% of the foxes. Just a year later, Ludmila has to come up with yet another category that she refers to as the class 1E, or the elite domesticated foxes. And here's the way she describes them in her own words. In the 6th generation, there appeared pups that eagerly sought contact with humans, not only tail wagging, but also whining, whimpering, and licking our hands in a dog-like manner. What's more, a few of the elite domesticated foxes were not just wagging their tails, a few of them were wagging their curly tails. The first of those characteristics in the domestication syndrome has now appeared in the foxes. So a couple of more years pass. It's 1967, and now Lysenko is no longer a problem. He's out of power. And this is the year that they have this experimental fox farm that they've built outside of Akadem Gordok, where they can run the experiment. This is what it looks like on a nice day in the Siberian winter, where each one of those sheds houses maybe 50 foxes, and at any given time there could be, you know, 500, 700, up to 1,000 foxes at the experimental farm. And this farm really changed the dynamic of the experiment for lots of reasons. First of all, it meant that Ludmila and now a team of people could be working on the experiment every single day, not just four times a year, even if it's for a few weeks or a few months, every day. The other thing that was really important to Ludmila was that when she was down at Lesnoy, Beleyev rarely had the time to visit, maybe one day a year. And so when she had new ideas and wanted to kick around thoughts with him, it had to be in between when she was back up at Akadem Gordok, because there was really no good phone system and the letters took forever. And so she was really limited. But now, Beleyev could come and interact with the foxes anytime he wanted to. And just as important, if something major happened, something dramatically important happened, Ludmila could call Beleyev and he could be out there immediately. And one of those really important things that happened was this little guy right here, Mechda, or Dream. Dream was the first of the domesticated foxes to have floppy ears. Another one of the characteristics in the domestication syndrome. So here's the story about foxes and ears. In the wild, wild foxes do have really floppy, droopy ears till they're about 6 weeks old. And then their ears shoot really straight up, the way that you envision a fox in the wild. But at 6 weeks, Dream's ears were still flopping, and at 2 months they were flopping, and at 3 months they were still flopping, and at 4 months they were still flopping. And Ludmila called Beleyev out there to show him Dream. And she remembers this so well. He turned around and he looked at her and said, "What kind of wonder is this?" Now, they not only had really friendly animals with curly tails, but a few of them had these floppy ears. And Beleyev would take a slide of Dream with him when he went to talk about the fox experiment, now not only in the Soviet Union, but he's beginning to go around the world talking about this. And he would tell Ludmila when he came back from one of these trips that people in the audience, his scientific colleagues, some of them would come up to him after the talk and accuse him of putting up a picture of a dog puppy just to convince them that the experiment was working. That's how much Dream looked like a little dog puppy. And keep in mind now, all along, right, the only thing they ever use to determine who's going to breed for the next generation or not is how friendly they are. It doesn't matter if you have floppy ears in terms of whether you're chosen to breed for the next generation. Nonetheless, curly tail and floppy ears are starting to become more common. So the experiment goes on, year after year after year. And one of the things that Ludmila and her team had been doing all along is taking blood samples and measuring different hormone levels. And what they found was that their domesticated foxes had dramatically lower stress hormone levels, half the typical stress hormone level of a wild fox. Now, by this time, they've also got another part to the experiment. In addition to choosing the 10% that are calmest, they are now creating a control line of foxes. So any good science experiment is going to have a control line. And the control here is all foxes are tested the exact same way in terms of scored on how friendly they are to behaviors towards humans. The control foxes are randomly selected with respect to how friendly they are to humans. So they're a perfect comparison to the domesticated foxes. The domesticated foxes have 50% lower stress hormone levels than the control foxes do as well. And by this time, all sorts of other amazing and interesting things were popping up in the domesticated foxes. So for example, domesticated pups open their eyes a day earlier on average than the control foxes and wild foxes. Domesticated pups respond to sounds 2 days earlier on average than wild foxes or the control foxes. Ludmila is a hardcore geneticist. But if you sit down with her over tea and cookies and she takes off her scientist hat, she will tell you that while these things were happening, they would joke around that it almost seemed like the domesticated pups just could not wait to start interacting with humans. They were also beginning to see another one of the characteristics that we see in domesticated animals. The domesticated foxes had a slightly longer reproductive period. So in wild foxes, in late January to early February, there's 10 days when they're in breeding season, that's their breeding season. Domesticated foxes were showing about a 14-day breeding season. Not dramatically longer, but it was a real change. So now, yet another one of the domestication syndrome traits. Also, all kinds of variation in their fur coloration. And in particular, this really strange white star-shaped pattern that was common on the foreheads of the domesticated foxes. If any of you study horses or you like horses, you'll know that there are breeds of horses that are like this. This white star-shaped pattern on the forehead is actually common in domesticated species. Now they're seeing it in their foxes. Okay, so at this point, they decide, Ludmila Belyaev and the Ho team decide they're going to expand the experiment even more. So they've got the foxes where they're choosing the top 10% that are friendliest. And they have the control foxes that they're choosing regardless, randomly with respect to how they act towards humans. Now, they're going to have a third group of foxes. And these are going to be chosen as the 10% that are least friendly towards humans, most aggressive towards humans. Now, there's a lot of reasons they did this. Okay. So for example, if you crossbreed the aggressive foxes with the domesticated foxes, you can understand what's happening at the genetic level. But there's another reason they did this. And that is that the kind of experiment they're doing in genetics is in a special kind of genetics called behavioral genetics, right? Because what they're choosing is they're choosing based on behavior. Right? And anytime you do a behavioral genetics experiment, you're always worried about something. So all the changes that they've been seeing in the behavior and in the fur and in the hormone levels and in the ears and the tails and all that, they've assumed that that's due to underlying genetic change because of what they've been selecting for. But when you do a behavioral genetics experiment, you're always worried that non-genetic factors are important, playing a role. So for example, maybe pups learn whether to be friendly or not towards humans by watching adults. Or maybe what kind of hormones you're exposed to during development in your mother's uterus, maybe that dramatically affects whether or not you're friendly or not towards humans. The only way to know, to see whether or not non-genetic factors are in play, they're assuming they aren't, but they don't know. The only way to know is to do an experiment. And these experiments are typically referred to as transplant experiments or common garden experiments, except now the common garden is going to be the uterus of a fox. So here's what Ludmila does. She has about 6 pairs of females, and each pair has one aggressive female and one tame or domesticated female, and both the females are pregnant. Okay? And this is what developing embryos look like in the uterus of a pregnant fox. So what Ludmila does is, even though no one has ever tried this with an animal as big as a fox, she learns from veterinarians and textbooks how to do a surgical transplant where she can swap some of the developing embryos from one fox, put them in the other, and vice versa. So when the foxes are just a week pregnant and the embryos are tiny, smaller than you can barely see them with your eye, she takes half of the developing embryos from an aggressive mother and transplants them over here and takes half of the developing embryos of a domesticated female and transplants them over there. So now both these pregnant females, they're carrying their genetic offspring and they're carrying foster offspring from the other kind of female. This is the perfect experiment to see whether or not non-genetic factors are at play. And the reason is, what you do is, as soon as the mothers give birth and the pups are up and about, you see how they behave. And the question is, do you behave like your genetic mother, regardless of whether or not you happen to develop in her uterus? If you do, then you have really strong evidence that the changes you're seeing are due to genetic changes. But if the pups behave like their foster mother, then that suggests non-genetic factors. Okay, so Ludmila does this with 5 or 6 pairs of pregnant females. And it's all good, except she has a tiny little problem, which is this. When she swaps the developing embryos, she knows who's who. She's moving 3 of these over here and 3 of these over here. But how is she going to know who's who when the pups are born? Fortunately, the foxes provide the answer, because we know a lot about fur coloration in foxes. It's a very well-studied genetic trait. Light-colored foxes produce light-colored pups. Dark-colored foxes produce dark-colored pups. So Ludmila color codes the parents. So in some of the pairs, the domesticated female and the domesticated male are light, and the aggressive ones are dark, and in some the other way. And so she always knows by the color of the pup's fur who their genetic mothers are. So as soon as they're up and about walking, Ludmila is there studying the pups. Okay. I'm going to show you the results from one of the aggressive females who gives birth to pups, remembering now that half of them are her foster pups and half of them are her genetic pups. And I'm going to let Ludmila describe it in her own words. But I want you to know that what you're looking at here is not just for this fox, but it basically holds true for all the females in this experiment. But I'm just going to show it to you for one. Okay, so here's Ludmila. It was fascinating. The aggressive mother had both foster and her genetic offspring. Now, that's the way the experiment was designed. Her foster tame offspring were barely walking, but if there was a human standing by the cage, they were already rushing to the cage doors, wagging their tails and licking Ludmila's hand, exactly the way their genetic mother would. Then, Ludmila continues, she, the mother, was punishing her foster tame pups for, I love this phrase, such improper behavior. She picked them up, she growled at them, she picked them up, she threw them into the corner of the nest, and what did they do but get up, walk over to the cage, and try to start licking Ludmila's hand again, behaving exactly the way that a domesticated pup should behave, even though they were raised in the uterus of an aggressive fox. Now, what about the other pups that were born to the same female? It's the genetic offspring of this mother. And again, here's Ludmila's words. I love them. They retain their dignity, growling aggressively the same as their mother and running to their nests. This was true when you looked at all the pups that were born to the aggressive mothers. That is, the tame foster pups behave like a domesticated pup should behave, and the genetic offspring of the aggressive mother behave the way an aggressive pup should behave. Same thing when you look at the offspring born to the domesticated female. Her genetic offspring behaved like a good domesticated fox should, and her foster offspring from the aggressive mother behaved exactly the way an aggressive fox behaved, providing really strong evidence that the changes they were seeing were due to underlying genetic changes, that non-genetic factors were not playing a role. Okay, so now the experiment is working, and it's working faster than Beleyev or Ludmila ever dreamed that it would. 15 years, 15 generations, that's nothing in terms of real evolutionary time, and all the changes they were seeing. So Ludmila now goes to Beleyev with this audacious idea. She says, there's this little house on the experimental farm. I want to move in there with one of the domesticated females, and I want to see just how far down the path of domestication these foxes have come. I'll live with them the way we live with our dogs. I'll take notes on her constantly. And we'll see how she behaves when she lives with humans, the way that we live with our dogs, the way that our ancestors lived with proto-dogs. Yes, it's a sample size of one. It's not an experiment. In the experiment, the foxes only interact with humans once when they're tested as a pup and once as an adult. But now she'll live with them all the time. See what happens. And she has the perfect fox in mind. The fox's name is Pushinka, which means tiny ball of fluff. Beleyev loves the idea, says, let's do this. This is the only picture we have of Pushinka being petted here by Beleyev. Ludmila decides that what she's going to do is she's actually going to wait a little bit. She's going to wait until Pushinka is a year old. And then she'll mate Pushinka with one of the elite domesticated males. And then when Pushinka's just about ready to give birth, that's when she'll move into the house with her. So the idea is now she can not only live with and take notes on everything Pushinka does, but she can live with and take notes on everything that domesticated pups do when, from the moment they're born, they're interacting with humans, the way that we interact with our dog pups. So the experimental house still stands today. But if you go inside, it's just junk. It's just rubble, broken up stuff. And the reason that I'm showing you rubble is this. The first time I went there in 2012, it was January. And it was minus 40 degrees outside. And there was this much snow on the ground. And Ludmila is about over here. And she, at 80 years old almost, insisted upon taking me out to the house and walking me through every room, telling me stories like, this is where Pushinka used to lie at the edge of my bed. This is where the pups and I used to play ball. This is where they'd go out in the yard and they'd respond to their names. So they're living together, day after day. And soon after they move in, Pushinka gives birth, that's the way it was designed, to six pups. One of them is named Pushak, which is the male version of tiny ball of fluff or tiny ball of fuzz. Here he is playing with a ball. So they're living together, they move in April or late March, and they're living together for 3 months. And during this 3 months, lots of people are coming to visit. It's like a celebrity house. Beleyev takes not only visiting scientists, but everybody to this house. He takes Russian generals from World War II to the house, and they melt when Pushinka jumps onto their lap and asks for a belly rub. And during that 3 months, with all these people coming in, never once did Pushinka or the pups behave in an aggressive way towards a human. And then something happened on the night of July 15th that fundamentally changed Ludmila. So this is a picture that I took when it was January. But in July in Siberia, it can get very hot. It could get to be 30 degrees outside. And every night on the other side of this house, there's a little bench. And Ludmila would sit reading a book, just relaxing, and Pushinka would be by her side, and she'd be petting Pushinka the way that you would pet your dog. And around 6 p.m. or 7 p.m. every night, a night watch person would come around to make sure everything was okay on the farm. And they had just hired a new night watch person that nobody knew. And this person was approaching Ludmila and Pushinka, you know, really quickly in a way that you might interpret as being aggressive. And Ludmila looked down and she could not believe what was happening. Pushinka had jumped up, charged towards the night watch person, and began barking at them exactly the way that a guard dog would bark if its master was in danger. And that was Ludmila's first thought. Pushinka's protecting me. She thinks I'm in danger. But then Ludmila said, wait a minute. I know how easy it is to fall into that trap, to think that the animals are doing what we would do if we were in that position. But then something happened. And that was that Ludmila went to the watch person and began talking to them in a very calm way. And when Pushinka saw that Ludmila was not in danger, She stopped barking. And I should say that the barking sound that she made, no other fox in the 15 years of the experiment had ever made that sound. She stopped making that sound, gently walked back over to the bench, and waited for Ludmilla to sit down and start petting her again. So is it possible that Pushinka wasn't protecting Ludmilla? Of course it's possible. But the question behind moving into the house was, how far down the path of domestication have these foxes come? And Pushinka answered that question for Ludmilla. And because you become responsible forever for what you have tamed, Ludmilla will tell you that from that night forward, she knew she could never leave the experiment, and she never has. Let me just take 5 more minutes to tell you a couple of other things they've been finding in this experiment. First of all, I told you before that in the 70s, they were seeing that the foxes had a longer reproductive period. But then in the early 80s, in 83 or 84, something really remarkable happened. Some of the elite females were ready to breed a second time during the year, not just in the January-February time slot that's normal, but a second time in September. Never, ever heard of in foxes, period. Ludmilla found some elite males that would mate with them. She bred them, and they produced a second clutch of pups. Again, never ever recorded in foxes. Think about how radically changed your reproductive system has to be for that to happen. All as the result of selecting for the friendliest, calmest animals. By the 80s and 90s, Ludmilla was working with people from all over the world that had really sophisticated equipment that allowed them to measure the faces and bodies of these foxes. And here's a couple of key things they found. First of all, the domesticated foxes have a shorter, rounder, more dog-like snout than the control foxes or the aggressive foxes or wild foxes. The other thing is, when you think of a wild fox, you might think of those really thin legs they have running around. The domesticated foxes are like lower to the ground and chunkier, all because there's been a selection process for calm, friendly behavior and nothing else. As we get into the 21st century, all kinds of work being done in molecular genetics. And a scientist by the name of Anna Kukukova approached Ludmilla and said, let's study the underlying genetic changes here, the molecular genetic changes. And Anna learned something that everyone who works with Ludmilla learns, which is that if you have an idea that can help her better understand her foxes, she will work with you in a way that will make your head spin. And before Anna knew it, she had hundreds and hundreds of blood samples, and they began doing an analysis. And they'd done tons of different things. I just want to show you one or two quick things. So one of the first questions they asked was this. They're seeing all these changes, right? Changes in behavior and changes in fur coloration and reproductive system and all the things we've talked about. If you look at the molecular genetic level, are those changes kind of spread all over the fox's chromosomes, or are they localized in kind of hot spots? In QTLs for biologists. And it turned out that one of the first analyses they did showed that many of the changes could be localized to one fox chromosome. Not all, but many could be localized to fox chromosome 12. The interesting thing is, at the same time, dog geneticists were asking the same question about dogs. Are the underlying molecular genetic changes in dog domestication scattered across their chromosomes, or are they localized in hotspots? So foxes and dogs have different numbers of chromosomes. Essentially, fox chromosome number 12 is homologous. That means it's divided essentially here, and chunks of it are on 3 dog chromosomes. And lo and behold, many of the underlying genetic changes associated with dog domestication are found on one of these chromosomes. So even deep down at the molecular genetic level, it looks like they're mimicking what happened during dog domestication. They've also been looking at another kind of genetics. Instead of just asking sort of how common are certain genes and where are they, They've been asking questions about what's known as gene expression. And gene expression is essentially asking this question. Are there differences between the domesticated foxes and other foxes in when genes turn on and when they turn off, when they produce something and when they stop producing something? Right? Not is a gene present or absent or at a different frequency, but does it turn on and off at different times? And they study that gene expression in fox brains. And what they found was that there were 146 genes in one part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, and 33 genes in another part of the brain that are expressed differently in the domesticated foxes. They're turned on and off at different times than compared to other foxes, compared to the control foxes. And some of these genes, we actually know what they do, not all of them by any means, some of them. And there are many, and the ones we know about, they're associated with things that make sense in terms of what you might expect in domesticated animals. Things like serotonin and other kinds of receptor pathways that make sense in terms of what you would expect in a domesticated species. Last trait. And this one may be my favorite thing in the domesticated foxes. But before I tell you what it is, I want to tell you why it's my favorite trait. First of all, what you're going to learn about in a second, this trait did not appear in the domesticated foxes till about 15 years ago or so. Okay, so think about that. That means this experiment was going on for 45 years before this new trait emerged. For people in the audience, especially the kids, if you study a particular animal or a particular set of questions for 30 years, you're going to start getting awards for lifetime achievement. And you will not have studied that system nearly long enough to see this sort of thing. This experiment is the poster child for why long-term experiments are important. The other reason that I love this trait so much is that it's hard to imagine anything more perfect for a domesticated pet-like species to have than this. And here's the story. In the early 2000s, an animal behaviorist by the name of Svetlana Gogolova approached Ludmila. And Svetlana studies animal vocalizations, animal communication. And she said, I want to come out to Akademgorodok and I want to study the sounds that all the foxes on the farm make, the aggressive foxes, the control foxes, and the domesticated foxes, and see if anything interesting is going on. So Ludmila says, come. And Svetlana comes year after year, and she gathers 2,000 hours of tapes of the sounds that these animals make. And this is just to show you that there are about 8 different kinds of sounds the foxes make if you look across all the different types of foxes, aggressive, control, and domesticated. There are 2, and I'm going to focus on 1, that only the domesticated foxes make. All of them make it, and they make it from essentially as young as they start walking. And here is what that sound is. If you map that out on a spectrogram and you visualize that, there is no sound made by non-humans that is closer to human laughter than that sound. And that's why I say it's almost too perfect. Not only do you have these loving, adorable foxes, but now they will laugh with you when you're laughing. They will laugh with you when you're upset. They will laugh with you regardless of what you are doing. This is the trait they understand least because it's the one that's appeared most recently, but they're trying. They're working on experiments and various things to understand what's going on here. So if you ask Ludmila today what her hopes and dreams are after 60 years leading this experiment, what she'll tell you is, but you'll get a 6-hour answer that I will condense down to just a couple of points. The first thing she'll tell you is I hope that it's possible to register them as a new pet species. So there are actually a couple of dozen of these foxes that do live as pets in people's houses. They're very expensive, like 5,000 euro, but all the money goes to the experiment. The thing is that technically speaking, they are still considered an exotic species. It turns out that there is a procedure you have to go through at the international level to get an animal certified as a domesticated house pet. And Ludmila and her team are working on that, but it's very complicated. When they're an exotic species, that means that the rules for whether you can have one are going to be different in Germany than they are in Austria, than they are in the United States. They're going to be different in what region in Germany you live in. They're going to be different in what subdivision in that region you live in, whatever the laws are. But when they're certified as a house pet, like a dog or a cat, then you can have them anywhere. And the idea is that they have plenty of foxes, that they could put 100 or 200 foxes in people's houses every year and still have plenty of foxes to keep the experiment going. And eventually, that's what they want to do. And Ludmila will also tell you, one day I will be gone, but I want my foxes and the experiment to live forever. I do, I hope you do, and I appreciate you coming out tonight to hear this. Thank you very much.